have a tech element today, and technology hates me, so you may have to use your imagination for that part. We'll see. I started thinking about everyday spirituality last year when a Facebook friend of mine linked to Jim Wilson's recording called God's Chorus of Crickets. Let's see if I can get that going. A narrator claims that the sound is made from two tracks. First, a normal recording of crickets, and second, crickets slowed way down to a rate that would make a cricket's life as long as a person's life. Can anyone hear it, or is it just... So as I researched this recording a little bit, I found that there are generally two responses to it. Some people claim that it's evidence that God shows us beauty in ways that we could never fully comprehend. And others claim it's a hoax. And this is frustrating to me because I wanted a third option. I wanted people to claim that everyday life is beautiful if we take the time to appreciate it. Because that's what I'm supposed to be talking about here today. But I didn't see much of that. It's either a gift from God or it's a hoax. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of the Facebook friends who will say, started my day with a beautiful rainbow, God is good, and I always wonder if they would follow it up with, oh, now it's hailing on my car, God is evil. But they tend not to do that. But it gets me thinking about moments of appreciation, those moments of wonder. I wanted to appreciate the everyday beauty of a cricket singing in a way that's kind of just hidden just beyond our threshold for hearing it. But I had to find out if it was real first. So NPR, Snopes, and a waffle-themed website that seems surprisingly knowledgeable about such matters were hesitant to debunk it entirely. But no one was able to reproduce the sound. And they suspect that there's more going on here than just manipulating the one track. So in the end, all in all, the miracles of crickets are probably a poor example for inspiring a belief in the everyday sacred. Today, I'd like to reflect a little bit on the challenges of skepticism and wonder, the need to make a spiritual connection with our everyday lives, and the potential for finding the sacred through some of our more mundane tasks. So my first question is, does a reasoned, skeptical approach sacrifice some of our wonder? Should we jettison our sense of awe because we have a pretty good idea about what it is we're seeing or what it is we're hearing? And in some sense, we have to. We can't stay like Kelvin from Calvin and Hobbes, marveling when the toast pops out of the toaster and wondering, where does the bread go? We've moved beyond that. So if we can't be awestruck by the mundane, we have another option available to us. We can be easily impressed. And by this, I don't mean faking a sense of wonder for the saccharine and the coincidental. We are complex organisms who've created a complex society and a complex universe. Finding something to be easily impressed by shouldn't be that tough. I imagine it must be kind of what it's like to be a magician. When I was young, I'd make my parents drive me to St. Paul Magic in costume. And I would go, and I would get bilked into buying the most ridiculous magic tricks, because that was the only way I could figure out how they're done, is to buy them and then read the instructions. Oh, that's how they do it. But since they let me go there and spend my allowance money, I got to see when professional magicians would come in and perform for the employees there. And the employees would sit and watch, and they would say, oh, yeah, you've done a great job. You've got fantastic patter, or that's a really nice flourish that you've added at the end. They knew that the deck was fixed. They knew that the ball was in the other hand, but they had plenty to praise. So despite knowing it was all a trick, they were impressed. They're not impressed with the magic. They're impressed with the work that goes into it. So it's nice. It's nice to be impressed by the world around us. But it's more than nice. It's important. In his commencement speech at Kenyon College, David Foster Wallace reminded the new graduates that the most obvious, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. One such part involves boredom, routine, and petty frustration. Of course, it's hard to wait in a long checkout line at the end of the day when you've got a surly, cranky cashier who just seems to be totally incompetent, holding up the entire line. Or it's tough to be behind a reckless, giant, exhaust-belching SUV, and we feel that kind of natural frustration or disgust that he calls our default setting. He continues, "It's the automatic way that I experience the boring, frustrating, crowded parts of adult life when I'm operating on the automatic, unconscious belief that I am the center of the world and that my immediate needs and feelings are what should determine the world's priorities." Wallace reminds his audience that each of these people have their stories too. The SUV may be bringing an injured child to the hospital. The cashier might be working two jobs to make ends meet. If you really learn how to pay attention, Wallace claims, then you will know there are other options. It will actually be within your power to experience crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell-type situations and not only feel meaningful, but sacred, on fire, with the same force that made the stars, love, fellowship, and the mystical one, oneness of all things deep down. Howling at the SUVs and the other drivers accomplishes little other than making us shrill, unhealthy, and reckless ourselves. It diminishes us. So these moments are the ones that seem to be most in need of the sacred, the connections to the world around us. One of the great challenges, I think, of the 21st century is integrating our potential, our access to unprecedented information and astounding technology with the everyday grind that seems to make up so much of our lives. But we can reconcile these different elements by appreciating both of them in equal measure, by elevating the mundane. The New Age philosopher David Spangler wrote, "In the midst of the boring times, the happy times, the angry times, and the routine times, performing a blessing may be the last thing on our minds. In the midst of the ordinary and the trivial, we tend not to think of the power of the sacred or the presence of the unobstructed world. But a blessing can be any time we wish to make a deep connection with the life and lives around us. As much as it's an invocation, it's an act of discovering the part of us that moves in harmony on the dance floor of creation." For me, these moments are some of those thankless household tasks that need to be done. Mowing the lawn, washing the dishes, shoveling the driveway, folding the laundry. And these are often solitary tasks. So I really like Spangler's metaphor. Moving in harmony on the dance floor of creation. It suggests that no matter what our own individual dance is, we are surrounded by other dancers. We may act alone, but we move together as a community, even as a species. When I was young, I always used to think of snow shoveling as solitary. And I kind of thought, as the snow is falling, it muffles the sound, and it obscures what you can see. And it felt like a very lonely kind of activity. But I don't feel that way here. I don't feel that way in Winona. When it starts to snow, the neighborhood goes out and shovels. It's a chorus. It's a cacophony. And when we're done, then we go into work and we talk about snow shoveling. And it becomes a real community participation kind of event. It's our shared duty as Minnesotans to clear a path to our door and to let the world know, hey, I am still here. We can still reach each other. Okay. And now I see that my neighbors, Matt and Sarah, in the front row. So sometimes I wait a day after. maybe two. The idea of reflecting on an unseen community is the antidote to what a motherhood blogger named Glennon Melton calls momotony. The repetitive actions, the songs, the needs, and stories of motherhood, she argues, put moms into a category similar to monks. Both groups do a lot of manual labor. They serve others. They nurse the sick, feed the hungry. They comfort the sad. Both groups sing. They teach and they improve over time through practice and good listening. Melton claims that these acts of service comprise a spiritual discipline. The fact that they are accomplished daily all over the world seems to her like a kind of communion. She reminds mothers that today you did the holy work of raising human beings. With each word spoken or unspoken, with each offering of forgiveness, you show your children what it means to be brave and kind. The mundane becomes the holy, the ordinary extraordinary. Together we're doing something beautiful, the sacred work of shaping humans and creating the future. Is that corny? I think it sounds really good on Facebook. But in the thick of things, when you're changing diapers or cleaning Capri Sun out of the piano, it doesn't feel like holy work. I remember I had this vision of when Aaron was 3, and he thought that the CD slot on our car was a coin slot, and stuck an entire roll of quarters into the CD slot, which started to melt and then shorted out the electrical system in the car. And I did not feel particularly spiritually fulfilled that day. And then later, when Rowan found a pocket calculator and found a way to systematically peel the buttons off and eat them, he ate 8 of them, actually. That was not a sacred day for me either. So there's nothing that feels uniquely fulfilling about, say, a daily choir practice. For me, I didn't feel any connection to the sacred until we had learned the music and learned it well. But the music we performed wouldn't have existed without the music that we practiced. And it's kind of like that with children. The values that we teach our children will help them learn, or hopefully soon learn, sometime in the next few weeks, please, those values that we've developed over years of establishing routines, correcting mistakes, and cleaning messes. The daily tasks we do each day are the short-term accomplishments that move us toward what should be our ultimate goal, making the world a better place. I think we can also look at the kinds of rituals that people find sacred. Rituals of purification, rites of passage, transformation, and communion. These are parts of the holy tasks that we do every day. In Alice Peck's anthology Next to Godliness, Jeanette Betts notes that washing dishes, doing laundry, dusting, and polishing are acts of purifying the household. They make them into spaces that we have deemed worthy. She notes that we cross boundaries by bringing in the groceries and bringing out the garbage. We transform objects when we cook or when we bake. She says that even breakfast can be a powerful rite. Scarfing down our daily bagel, she says, we forget what a powerful transaction the domestic act of sustenance can be. Food gives us strength. Food gives us strength, continuity, reassurance. It mediates between our vulnerable insides and the outside world, between what is self and what is other. That is an impressive bagel. But more than that, that's impressive work. Our daily tasks are the affirmations that we are worthy. We have made a space in this world at this time, and we will care for that space in the grand tradition of human beings from the earliest existence. The fact that we know how it happens, that we can see the glue and the hidden strings and the messy rehearsals that take us from just getting by to earning our place among the multitude does not diminish its impressiveness. In fact, this is what it should take to impress us. We've got a difficult goal, a complicated path, and the desire to see our way toward that goal even during setbacks. This is how revolutions occur. This is how the impossible becomes possible. This is how the house gets clean. Once we realize this, that we have lofty goals we work at every day, and that these goals have been echoed by people throughout civilization, we can find and reflect upon sacred moments throughout our day. And what's even better is the kind of work that we do begs for those moments of reflection. When we put our hands to work at a task that doesn't command our mental faculties, we can find moments for appreciation. This becomes a perfect opportunity for us to work on the 7 factors of Buddhist enlightenment: investigation, tranquility, concentration, energy, equanimity, mindfulness, and happiness. Investigate the dirty pots and pans. Think about the sacred work that caused them to need purification. Submerge your hands into the warm water and feel tranquility as your muscle memory takes over and the purification process begins. Concentrate. Put your entire mind to the stubborn stains that require extra care and attention. Pour this concentration into energy, a vigorous application of dish soap and scrubbing that transforms the object in your hand. As you stack the dishes into the drying rack, feel equanimity. The easy coffee cups and the difficult frying pan end up in the same rack. They are both parts of accomplishing the same goal. As you put away the dishes, be mindful of your role in the process, that you're like an instrument in resetting the instruments of the house, a carrier of the grand tradition of returning things to their rightful place, but also of this moment. Look upon your work and feel the happiness of completed work. Have you achieved enlightenment? Put it this way: you've achieved clean dishes. And of course, these approaches can translate into any number of tasks. Sweeping the floor, folding the clothes, gardening. Is there any task that puts us in a mindset to cling to the sacred more than gardening? We can visualize our own growth as seeds become sprouts and bear fruit. We think about our needs as we sink our hands into the rich soil or water a thirsty turnip. We can muse upon the nature of life and death among the weeds, the value of work, the cycles of life as the plant, the soil, and our own selves feed each other. Alfred Austin wrote of the glory of gardening, saying, "Hands in the dirt, head in the sun, heart with nature." To nurture a garden is to feed not just the body, but the soul. We've seen plants thrive. We've seen them wither. The more we know about the complicated factors that go into producing vegetables, the more impressive the task becomes. And while you're out there, you might just happen to hear the stridulation of a serrated scraper vein along the bottom of a wing as it brushes against the file of another wing. This is one of 4 cricket songs performed by the male cricket between the months of March and November. Cricket songs have evolved over thousands of years, but in one case for crickets in Hawaii, in just 10 years, 90% of the crickets have developed flat wings and stopped singing in order to avoid attracting a certain parasite that lives out there. So the crickets there have become mostly silent. Their song is a sound that I enjoyed hearing earlier this week, at least before the temperatures plummeted. It connects me to my past, those late nights where I'd stay up and try to make it look like the cards had really disappeared, or taking an evening walk with my family after retrieving the calculator buttons. And it sounds a little like this, if it works. And if it doesn't work, you'll have to use your imagination. It's a sound that I think is kind of amazing, and one that I would suggest that perhaps you take a couple moments to stop and appreciate. But then, I'm easily impressed. Thanks.
You will now sing hymn number 77.